Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program, very remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, August 26, 2020. Residents of Melut are protesting against environmental damages around oil fields in Upper Nile.
The residents are supposed to benefit from the oil being produced in their area. It is their right. Since 1997, it has been over 20 years now, oil is being drilled, but there are no good schools.
And Sudan and Ethiopia have committed to a peaceful settlement of the conflict over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam.
Both sides emphasize the imperative of exerting every possible effort to attain a successful conclusion of the ongoing trilateral negotiation under the auspices of the AU.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Residents of Melut continued with their protest against environmental pollution for the third day. The protesters blocked entrances to some of the oil companies operating in Fallujah and Melut. One of the protesters in Fallujah accuses the oil companies of disposing wastewater and toxic chemicals in the area, contaminating the environment. For VOA News, David Monodanga reports from Juba.
Protester Ton Benny Ton, a resident of Paluch, says oil companies have polluted nearby land with toxic waste water and chemicals. He also accuses the government and oil companies of failing to live up to their commitment to reinvest a portion of oil revenues to improve local infrastructure. According to Ton, 18 local pregnant women died from various health conditions because they could not access proper medical care in Paluch.
The residents are supposed to benefit from the oil being produced in their area. It is their right. Since 1997, it has been over 20 years now. Oil is being drilled, but there are no good schools, no clean water, no roads, no hospitals, and nothing good for the residents. The environment is contaminated, causing so many health complications.
Thorn also claims women have given birth to babies with deformities and there are more miscarriages due to polluted land and water from the oil companies. He also says chickens and other farm animals have died in the area due to environmental pollution. South Sudan in Focus was unable to independently verify Thorn's accusations. Residents have been protesting since Monday in hopes of getting the attention of the government and petroleum companies that operate in the area. Thorn says protesters will continue to block the doors of oil companies, block major roads leading in and out of Paluch and the local airstrip until petroleum ministry officials address their demands.
We have closed all oil fields, even the airport is closed. A plane came but left back to Juba. It could not land because our demands have to be answered. There is no way we can strike here, and the government continues to work, and no one wants to come to us. We have asked the Minister of Petroleum, Minister of Labor, Minister of Environment, and the Director of the Oil Company to come and listen to our demands.
Repeated calls and text messages to the Ministry of Petroleum's Undersecretary, Daniel Awoh, for comment went unanswered. South Sudan's Petroleum Revenue Management Act 2012 establishes a formalized structure for distributing a portion of petroleum revenues to local communities for improving infrastructure. It also sets a high bar for reporting requirements for both the government and oil companies, with the overarching principle of transparency and accountability in management. Thorn says the 3% of revenues allocated for the development of communities in oil-producing areas is insufficient. Oil fields in Paluch and Melut are run by Dar Petroleum Operating Company, or DPOC, a consortium of companies led by China's National Petroleum Corporation, Malaysia's Petronas, South Sudan's Nilepet, Sinopec, and Three Ocean Energy. DPOC engineer Peter Abuluk confirms that protesters have interrupted the company's operations in Paloj. He says the protesters locked the company's employees in their compound since 4 o'clock Monday morning.
The guys are well organized, just burning ties at the main gate of operation base camp. The lock, no one is going outside. So we have been just inside. The problem now is going to work on the site. This is the wells. It's the main problem now because most of the works are done outside.
In Meilut, community members issued a statement Tuesday threatening to conduct violent protest if the government and oil companies fail to address their demands, including employment opportunities for local citizens, health care services, and cleaning up environmental pollution caused by oil companies. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
Sudan and Ethiopia have committed to a peaceful settlement of the conflict over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok and Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed met in Khartoum Tuesday and renewed their support to the African Union-led negotiations. The two leaders discussed how to involve Egyptian authorities in direct talks over the Nile-based conflict. For VOA News, Michael Atid reports from Khartoum.
The two leaders discussed bilateral relations and regional cooperation on peace, security, economic development at the Rwanda summit in Khartoum. At a joint news conference afterward, Sudanese Information Minister Faisal Mohamed Saleh read a final communique from Ahmed and Hamdok on the River Nile Dam project.
Both sides emphasize the imperative of exerting every possible effort to attain a successful conclusion of the ongoing trilateral negotiation under the auspices of the AU, leading to a win-win formula that would make the GERD a vehicle for regional integration between the riparian countries.
Hamdok met with Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly in Khartoum last week, when both leaders expressed their support for African Union-led negotiations over the Ethiopian dam and water rights. Aside from improving peace and democracy in the region, Saleh says both Sudan and Ethiopia want to promote economic development for all countries affected by the Ethiopian dam.
Both governments reiterated mutual support for each other in their endeavors to attain and consolidate peace, stability, democracy, and development in their respective countries. They expressed shared conviction that, given the historical, cultural, social, and economic ties between the two brotherly peoples, embarking on regional integration is the way forward to fulfill their people's aspiration in peace, development, and Pan-African unity.
Saleh says Prime Minister Ahmed expressed his full support to the Sudanese transitional government and vowed to help it achieve lasting peace and economic prosperity.
The Ethiopian delegation was briefed about the progress in the ongoing peace talks in Juba and the imminent peace agreement between the transitional government of Sudan and the armed struggle forces. The efforts of the transitional government to overcome the economic difficulties inherited from the ousted regime and to address challenges of socio-economic development and strengthening democracy in the country were also highlighted.
Sudanese journalist Izzeddin Arbab, who has followed Ethiopia-Sudan relations for years, says the purpose of Ahmed's visit was to hear directly from Sudanese officials regarding their position on the dam project.
Both countries are very concerned about the attitude of Sudan regarding this dam. The Ethiopian side wanted to hear clearly. Sudan is very concerned as Egypt about the feeling of the dam.
Arbab believes Ahmed's visit was also aimed at evaluating the progress of the shared military-civilian transitional government in Sudan. Ethiopia played a significant role in resolving differences between the two sides after the ouster of longtime President Omar al-Bashir. Sudan, Egypt, and Ethiopia have all presented their draft proposals to the African Union over the management of Addis Ababa's giant hydroelectric dam. Egypt and Sudan worry the dam will threaten their vital water supplies, while Ethiopia considers the dam crucial to its plan for economic development. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
With measures to prevent the spread of COVID-19 wrecking economies, trade and budgets, the African Union and experts are looking at ways to bolster tax collection. In the firing line are digital multinationals operating on the continent, as Simon Max reports from Addis Ababa.
Tax officials in Africa estimate that government revenues will drop somewhere between 10 and 30% in 2020 as a result of the economic fallout stemming from the coronavirus pandemic. But while businesses in the hospitality, construction and retail sectors have suffered, digital companies have boomed as more people stay at home and conduct their activities online. This is driving talks in Africa about how to make sure big multinationals such as Google and Facebook, which do not always have a physical presence in the countries where they make a profit, can be taxed. Logan Wart, Executive Secretary of the African Tax Administration Forum, was among government officials, members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and African Union who gathered virtually Wednesday to address the issue. Wart said that due to the coronavirus, businesses in the sectors of e-commerce, online transactions and other digital services have experienced a huge boom. The e-commerce sector alone is projected to increase its revenues by 41%, according to the African Tax Administration Forum.
Question: are we collecting VAT on these transactions? Are we aware of these transactions? Are the businesses doing these, the businesses for these transactions, do they have a presence, a physical presence in our countries? And if not, do our regulations provide for them to be taxed?
Talks about how to roll out harmonized laws to allocate tax rights in cross-border transactions is currently underway among members of the OECD. This is because governments across the world are concerned there is a misalignment between the location where profits are reported and the location where economic activities occur. Victor Harrison, the Commissioner of Economic Affairs for the African Union, said the tax-to-GDP ratio in 26 African countries reporting to the AU is just 17.2% compared to 32.2% in developed countries that belong to the OECD. He called on more African countries to come forward and participate in talks on a global level about how to tax multinational companies so the profits from their wealth can be shared more equitably.
So far, only 25 African countries are part on this initiative, which is a cause for concern for the African Union. Corporate income tax is a substantial source of taxation in Africa, amounting to over 25% of total revenues in most countries.
David Masondo, Deputy Minister of Finance of South Africa, said Africa needs a central body within the African Union to speak with one voice on tax policies.
These unified policies should include or focus on improving the allocation of tax rights in cross-border transactions, including the digital transactions of multinational enterprises.
The US has pushed for its companies to be able to opt in and out of the global rules on taxing multinational companies as long as they adhere to certain basic principles. Annette Ogutu, a member of the High-Level Panel on Financial Accountability and Transparency, said while Europe was at loggerheads with the US over the matter, African countries also have a role to play in the discussion.
The focus of the discussion seems to be about the US protecting its multinationals and the European countries trying to get the best out of it. The question then is, where do we stand as developing countries in Africa? Perhaps coming together under the platform of ATAF could bring together a consensus, a more united front that could be able to address these issues.
Talks at a global level are due to reconvene in October, now that proposals about how to tax digital multinationals have been shared among governments. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, health experts say Africa is polio-free. That story is coming up after this break.
do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Tell me about your favorite person.
My favorite person is my best friend. And we've been best friends since when we're children. And we've grown up. We are in tertiary level and we are still very close and good friends.
My favorite person is my friend. And she's a lady who really knows her worth. She knows her values. She stands for her values and all. She doesn't compromise.
My mom is my favorite person. She inspires me. She gives me the courage to do anything that I want.
Me, I'm a fan of basketball. I play basketball. And the person I like and impresses me too much is LeBron James. I follow him so much and I like his game.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. World Health Organization has declared Africa free of the wild polio virus. The last case of the crippling disease was detected in 2016 in Nigeria. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Health officials are celebrating a momentous milestone. They are marking only the second eradication of a virus from the African continent since smallpox was wiped out 40 years ago. The journey toward this historic achievement began in 1996, when African heads of state committed to eradicate polio. That same year, South African President Nelson Mandela and service organization Rotary International launched a Kick Polio Out of Africa campaign. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, calls it a game changer. Over the past 24 years, she says polio eradication efforts have prevented up to 1.8 million children from suffering from the disease's crippling lifelong paralysis and saved some 180,000 lives. Now, she says, future generations of African children can live free of wild polio. She says the threat of circulating vaccine-derived polio viruses must be stopped.
Currently, 16 African countries are responding to outbreaks of vaccine-derived polioviruses, which are a less common form of polio that affects populations where there is poor sanitation and low immunization coverage. The COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted the response to some of these outbreaks with the suspension of vaccination campaigns.
Moeti says she is confident the problem will be overcome. The Independent African Regional Certification Commission considered Africa polio-free after the continent passed four successive years without any detectable cases of the disease. The chair of the commission, Rose Leke, says Cameroon, the Central African Republic, South Sudan, and Nigeria were the last four countries to receive the wild polio-free status. Despite the good news, she says, countries will have to continue to be careful and not let down their guard. She says surveillance will have to be heightened and vaccination rates will have to be kept up to avert a resurgence of the wild polio virus.
There are still two countries in the world, Afghanistan and Pakistan, that are still harboring the transmission of the wild polio virus. So we can have importations at any time. So we need to heighten surveillance in all our countries. We need to improve on immunization coverage because it's important that we bring up the population immunity.
Leke says the wild polio virus does not respect borders. Until polio is wiped off the face of the earth, she says people will remain vulnerable to the crippling disease. She says countries will have to stay vigilant to maintain and sustain all the gains that have been made. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As the number of people infected by COVID-19 continues to increase worldwide, some young men and women in South Sudan are distributing free sanitizers and face masks to residents of Juba Town. The young men and women are also campaigning to dispel myths and misinformation about coronavirus. For VOA News, Ding Magot reports from Juba.
One youth group trying to control the spread of COVID-19 is Go Girls ICT, a Juba-based non-profit initiative that mentors young women in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM. Go Girls makes and distributes hand sanitizers. 30-year-old Yine Yenki Nyika is co-founder and mentorship director at the non-profit. When the government confirmed COVID-19 was in South Sudan, Nika says her group mobilized about 20 people, including 9 brewers, 5 chemistry teachers, and 2 aloe vera extractors to produce a hand sanitizer.
What we used as ingredients are, of course, alcohol makes 70% of our product. We used orange, stroke, lemon, epicap. So if you get orange, we use them. If you get lemon, we use them, which replaced the vitamin E and hydrogen peroxide as antioxidants, antiseptic and anti-inflammatory. We also used aloe vera gel from aloe vera leaf, which replaced the glycerol as a moisturizer.
Nika says her group produced a sample of the sanitizer called Go Sanitize and gave it to few Juba residents to get their feedback. Nika says the goal is to produce a high-quality sanitizer with the help of trained professionals.
The teachers come in because they have the expertise, they have the knowledge, they understand how actually this alcohol should be brewed, what's required, how to test, basically how to do quality analysis and control, since they have the knowledge.
Other youth are educating communities about COVID-19, dispelling myths about the pandemic. The youth rights group Voice Post in Juba has come up with something called the Blue Messenger Bicycles Project. Riders with blue bicycles outfitted with megaphones and amplifiers powered by a car battery with a USB port plugged into the amplifier blast a PSA about coronavirus in Juba's Gudele, Jebel, and Tongping neighborhoods. The message dispels rumors, misinformation, and myths about the pandemic. 33-year-old Daniel Atem is a communication specialist with Voice Post.
One blue messenger bicycle covers 200 households a day, and the megaphone is too loud to the extent that it covers 500 meters ahead and it covers 300 meters behind. So that means as the volunteer is riding and cycling with information, people ahead of him or her are able to be informed, and people behind as she or he is moving forward are also being informed.
Atem says, while radio is the main source of information on COVID-19 in South Sudan, not everyone has access to a radio, and points out that many South Sudanese are illiterate, so the blue bikes are performing an important service. The youth-led volunteer group Action for Recovery and Transformation, or ART, distributes face masks and educates the public about COVID-19. The head of the group, 32-year-old Denaya Denise, says he mobilizes volunteers who move from door to door and talk about COVID-19 preventive measures and hand out masks and hand sanitizers and soap.
There are, households, there are people, women that cannot even afford to buy, a face mask or even a washing facility to set up in their houses, looking at the incomes that are being affected. So with the little support that we had from Code 8, who are able to, disseminate the key guidelines as outlined by the Ministry of Health.
Dennis says the country's young people play a critical role in fighting COVID-19. Given that 70% of the population is people under 30. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
Hundreds of young activists took to the streets of the Liberian capital, Monrovia, on Tuesday to call on the government of President George Weah to declare rape as a national emergency. As Moses Gazewu reports from Monrovia, the protesters say they will remain on the streets for the next 3 days.
These were young men singing songs of solidarity as they march up to Capitol Hill, the seat of the Liberian government. Titus Bakala is the leader in Lee Campino for the March for Justice.
We are asking the government today to declare rape a national emergency. We are asking the government today to decentralize Criminal Code E in all of the counties in making sure that rape-related cases are fairly adjudicated. So we have so many recommendations to the government, but amongst them is declaring rape a national emergency.
Records shows that in the last 7 months, there have been over 900 rape cases in Liberia, something the protesters said elevates rape to epidemic status in Liberia. Benita Yure, a famous Liberian blogger, was one of the marchers.
Rape is at an alarming rise in Liberia, even more than the coronavirus. We started following up and found out that within 7 months, we've had 958 confirmed cases. That does not include the cases that have been compromised.
In Liberia, those convicted of rape charges spend from 5 years to life imprisonment, but that doesn't seem to have an impact on the culture of rape in the country. President of the Federation of Liberian Youth, Amos Williams, said he wants a tougher punishment for rape perpetrators.
We're also calling and asking that we look at the issue of the penalty, that perpetrators who are caught in the crime, we need some harsh penalty to that. We need to ensure that they go through some harsh penalty.
These were some of the slogans accompanied by face painting and placards carrying anti-rape campaign messages. Award-winning Liberian singer Maurice Givler, commonly called CIC, was also among the protesters. He said the protest was another way of fighting for the women and children of Liberia.
The numbers are getting higher day by day, so if we don't stay in the gap and fight it, nobody will fight for our sisters. And I believe they don't have the strength to fight for themselves right now, so we have to stay in the gap for them. I come not as CIC, but as a Liberian citizen as well, who is against rape and is saying no to rape, and the government must take a stand.
The protesters were expected to present petitions to the legislature and President George Weah, but the president was not immediately available. Instead, the protesters turned his general minister away. Patience Courtier had this message from President Weah.
We thank you for coming. We recommend you, but we demand that our president, the feminist in chief, talk to us. This is no form of disrespect. It's just our protocol, and this is what we need as young people.
However, members of the legislature were on hand to receive that petition from the young protesters. 14-year-old Aaron Smith read and presented a petition to the legislature.
Honorable members of the legislature, we have a rape pandemic on our hands. There has been hundreds of rape cases across the country, and the numbers keep climbing. These outrageous acts are only persisting because our justice system has been so weak.
Receiving a petition, Lofa County Representative Judy Fatoma Weah lauded the peaceful nature of the gathering and said she was in solidarity.
We want to make sure that we take this to our colleague. The full plenary will discuss this and arrange a public hearing, and we'll make sure that you people will be part of this hearing. And we want to work together to make sure that we put this in place. Like she said, enough is enough.
The protesters say they will remain in the streets for the next 3 days until President Weah's government yield to their demand to declare rape as a national emergency in the country. Moses Gazio, VOA News, Monrovia.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with Chico and the song, I Need Some Money. We've been listening to Chico with the song, I Need Some Money. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers, because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Yeah.